kind of weird to be doing a presentation on Zoom. I guess maybe some of you might be used to doing it a lot. I've done one already for another organization. I'm used to being in person. I'm used to asking questions. I'm used to my presentations being a conversation. So it's a little odd for me to be speaking to a screen. You guys are definitely welcome to respond to what I'm saying in the chat. But it's not really the same. So I'm going to share my PowerPoint with you. Okay, it's working out. Okay. So as you know, this is part of it's a two-part series. So tonight is tips for you for managing your own mental health. And then in 2 weeks, we'll be doing one that'll be tips for supporting someone that you love who are dealing with mental health. So this is a picture of me. I'll give you these. There's a story attached to this picture, and then later on I'll bring you some context to this story. So this is me. I had a bike accident. You can tell. I'm assuming you can't see my mouse moving around the screen, but you can tell my back is completely burnt here by the cement. This car came directly towards me, head-on collision. I rode on the hood for the car for a bit. It finally hit a pole, threw me off the car. My helmet cracked. I got all this cement burn on my back. Ultimately, my friend was biking with me. You can see my bike's under the car. And she was around me. She picked up all my stuff. She took pictures of everything, which is one of these pictures. You know, she was around when the paramedics came, when the ambulance came. She rode with me in the ambulance. She was with me at the hospital and even took the taxi home with me. And you can tell my bottle of wine there is broken on the street beside the car, but her bottle of wine was still around. So we took a taxi back to my house and had a glass of wine. And ultimately, my experience was actually relatively not so bad. Another friend of mine in about the same period also had a car accident, or bike accident. Her experience was very different. She was riding home around 2 a.m. after going dancing. She lives she lived in the West End. So it was a little more of a sketchy neighborhood. And she also got hit by a car 2 a.m. No one was around. It was a hit and run. And she had to walk her bike home because she couldn't ride it after that. She stayed in her house for 4 days, didn't leave her home. And I spoke with her recently and she told me she actually has not ridden her bike since. So two very different bicycle accident stories. I'll come back to that in a little bit. So this is my overview. I plan to speak mostly, spend most of my time on the attachment theory, talking about safety, talking about triggers and coping strategies. But I will quickly talk about medication and therapy. I will talk about a bit of personal growth, spirituality, and mental health and the pandemic, burning out, the value of exercise, and then we'll get to questions. And after the questions, there'll be an announcement. So we'll get into it. Oh yeah. So the way that I teach is always by using personal stories, either myself or others around me. But it's a little different tonight because this is being recorded, and so it feels kind of strange for me to be having my own personal stories recorded and maintained online for all eternity. So my request is that anyone who watches this video you know, tonight or like tonight it's live, but if you watch it later, just to treat my stories with respect, just because I you know, like I don't really don't think there's a better way for me to explain what I'm trying to say without giving you personal examples. And I'm very much okay and comfortable with that, but it's really just the eternalization of it on the internet that makes me feel a little odd. So I wanted to start by saying that there's no quick fixes for managing mental health. I think that so many people are, when they attend these kinds of presentations, they hope that there's gonna be some sort of like really fast solution, something that they can do that will make their problems go away immediately. And that doesn't really exist, but there are tips, there are ways to make it more manageable in the moment. If you go talk to your family doctor, generally they'll prescribe you medication and therapy if they're a good doctor. I don't want to criticize your doctor if he or she has not done that. They should be prescribing at least both and not just medication. And I'm really going to quickly go through this medication therapy thing because that's not the point of this presentation, but it feels like it would lack value if I didn't at least talk about it very quickly. So medication is always something that's important to consider as an option, but that's something you discuss with your family doctor or your psychiatrist. They'll help you make that decision. What I wanted to say though is that there's lots of research out there that says that like medication isn't the only answer. And so in fact, like in some of the in this particular research here that I'm citing, they go on to say that there's been a huge decrease in therapy and a huge increase in medication in the last number of years. So it does give the impression that people are less and less looking for sort of a therapeutic solution and more so a medication solution. So if you are on medication, I always encourage people to look for therapy as well. So this is a pretty fascinating quote. It says, while psychosocial interventions have received much less marketing attention than pharmaceutical or pharmacological treatments, the results are arguably more encouraging. So lots of research out there saying that therapy actually is better than medication. And this other quote here is also very interesting. They're in the quote, it's EBT. The definition for that is evidence-based psychological treatments. And they're saying here that they are frontline sole or adjunctive interventions for a broad range of mental disorders. So once again, I just want to encourage you, if you really need help, don't dismiss the value of therapy. And quickly, there are all kinds of different therapists, individual groups and support groups. So there's all kinds of options for you out there. And for those of you who say that you can't afford it, there are also, and this is definitely not an exhaustive list. There's just two small examples of the many options available for options that are almost free, if not maybe free. So the All-Know Renal Center has always done sort of like a based on income type of therapy. And they have during the pandemic been doing something called a check-in. And that's not therapy. It's really just calling in to receive strategies. And they can go up to about 50 minutes. And the Oro Family Therapy Center, they're attached to the U of W. And they have some of their students do therapy, so it's a lot cheaper, I think, and maybe even sometimes free, depending on your income. So don't let finances become coming in the way of you and your healing. It's possible, and that's all I'm going to say about that. So I'm going to jump into attachment theory. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in this diagram because we're not talking about childhood here, but I just kind of want to give you an idea of where this theory comes from. So the idea is that a child needs a secure base and a safe haven. So they at the same time, if they're going through some kind of emotional distress, they need to be able to come to the parent and be hugged and held and feel safe and protected and know that they're okay. They also need to explore the world and then know that if something happens to them, a dog barks and it scares them, that they have a place to go and be comforted. So ultimately, this really, the attachment theory lies on this idea of feeling safe and secure. And again, I'm not going into this. This is not the point of this evening, but there are many different types of attachment models that come out of this theory. Again, like that, if you're wanting to learn more about attachment, you can learn that, but this is not, we're not going to get into that. So I'm going to go back to these bicycle accidents. This is where, if we were in person, I would ask you all these questions, but we don't have that capacity right now. So I'm going to tell you the reason why I had ultimately a pretty wonderful bike accident experience is because I felt safe the whole time. Like, although it was a traumatic experience and my, like it could have been really bad, my helmet cracked and I had all this damage on my body. I had someone with me the whole time. So the entire time, even when someone was coming towards me, I still felt emotionally safe because I had someone at my side. And You know, this person was there the entire time from beginning to end. I never once felt alone, never once felt unsafe. I always felt like I had company. Whereas my friend who got hit by a car at 2 a.m. and hit and run by themselves, there was no sense of safety there. They were completely alone. And it was very traumatizing for her, especially because she was alone. So the point of this story is just to remind you, or maybe remind or encourage you, to continuously think about when your mental health is not doing well, what in this situation is making you feel unsafe, and how do you find ways of getting safety? So I'll give you another example of my work. So I work in a personal care home, and initially during the pandemic, the thought was that the residents, if they get COVID, they would stay in the room. We might sort of move residents around and have a COVID sort of ward on the unit itself. And as this has gone on, there's been, it's been proven that really what you need to do is have a dedicated ward specifically for COVID patients. So then when they get diagnosed, you bring them downstairs or whatever to the unit, and then it's all isolated. So ultimately, this decision was made to transform the chapel into the COVID unit at my work. And the reason behind that being is that we have a building, like there's no room in our building, and they needed to have access to an office and to a bathroom. And this was literally the only place in the whole building that had that possibility. And so my office, being a spiritual care provider, is in the chapel. And so my whole work area was taken over. And for a long time, it was transformed. However, the chapel was still remained used by everyone. It's just that it was halfway ready, and then we would sort of change it at the last minute. And eventually the decision was made that that it had to be just completely ready. And so then the question was, am I losing my office? Are they going to move me somewhere else? And for some reason, this whole like last minute decision, or the last minute, but this new development of like closing the chapel down completely, which, you know, like had been in this sort of prepared state for 2 months already, but now to have it in a fully prepared state, and then the idea of losing my office, was very traumatizing for me. And I really didn't know what was going on, but I was losing it. Like I was in crisis, you know, like not being able to function, crying. And I thought about it. I'm like, what's the deal, you know? And eventually I talked to some of the managers, and they had agreed already that I could keep my office, but still. And they also had agreed that even though we were closing down the chapel, we were going to move all the things out of the chapel to another area. And the residents could still have mass and they could still receive communion. So really there was no massive damage to all of this. I felt like in a way I had won. You know, I had argued that the residents still needed their spiritual care and they had agreed. And so I'm like, why am I feeling such distress, even though I feel like ultimately services are continuing? And it finally dawned on me that it was a question of, two things. One, I had been looking at the chapel as a sign of hope. As long as the chapel stood, COVID had not entered our building. And so now they were taking that visible sign of hope away from me. And thankfully, we still haven't had COVID in our building and all our residents are vaccinated. So I keep holding on to the hope that it won't happen. But anyway, the hope of losing the chapel was difficult for me. But the real problem, the reason my mental health like lost it entirely, was because my office is my safe zone at work. If I'm feeling distressed, if I need to cry, if I need a break, I just go to my office and it's my safe zone. And ultimately what was happening is that my safe zone was being possibly taken from me, even though they had told me that I could stay there. I still felt this uncertainty that at any moment my safe zone could be ripped away from me. And the uncertainty of losing my safety net was extremely distressing. But it took me some time to reflect on this, to finally figure out why I was distressed. And so my solution was to send an email to the managers and thank them for allowing me to stay in my office, and then actually tell them exactly why it mattered to me. And I said to them, it's my safe zone. because of my mental health, I need a place where I can feel safe, et cetera, et cetera. And I sort of I ousted myself. I didn't even realize what I was doing till it was done. I was like, oh man, I just told the managers that I have this, that I'm depression. And, but that was not even what I was thinking when I did it. It was like, literally, I need to reclaim my safe space and to make sure that it remains stable. And I succeeded. They were like, we're glad. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. And we're really glad you have your office. So in this particular situation, I was in crisis. I was like, okay, what's making me feel unsafe? How can I find safety again? And I found a solution to regain safety. So my biggest tip here, when it comes to managing your mental health, is when you're in crisis, continuously try to figure out what is making you feel unsafe. What is causing you a sense? What part of your distress has you feeling unsafe? And really, what I mean by unsafe is emotionally unsafe. I mean, I guess it could be physically, but generally, it is emotionally. So, what gives you a sense of safety? And I'll give you another example of this because I think it's so important. This doesn't happen to me all the time, but I'm making it seem like it happens to me always. But I was again in a crazy state of crisis on Friday. I got really bad news at work, and it was not about work, but I received it while I was at work, and it was so incredibly distressing. I don't remember feeling this distress in a very long time, and I couldn't even work. I was like, I can't be at work. I have to actually leave work on sick leave because I can't function. And I was trying to think, what in the world could I possibly do to make it through these next few hours? I don't know. I don't know what to do. And eventually I thought, you know what? my mom is the most sort of safe person I have, the person whom I feel the most comforted by. And although I don't let anyone in my house because of the pandemic, I just a sort of sense of moral responsibility, especially linked to the fact that I work in a personal care home. But I just had no choice. And I called my mom. She lives in the country. I'm like, I this is an emergency. I need to come at my house. I can't be alone. And she did. And it carried me through. Like, I had a Zoom date with some friends at 8 p.m. She came to my house. She stayed with me till my date. And then the next day I had a bunch of other outdoor visits planned. And I'm feeling completely okay again. But again, it was like, I was like, okay, what can I do to make me feel emotionally safe in this situation where I am in great distress? We're going to move on to triggers. So triggers, I guess I assume that you guys all know what that means, but I will try not to assume, and I'll maybe explain quickly. Always in the world, there are things that are happening that will cause you, that will create or bring up your problems, your mental health, put you in a mental health crisis. So my examples are based on me, so they'll deal with like anxiety and depression. But obviously you can think about it through your own examples or your own life experiences. Like, I know, like, you know, I have a few friends of mine who have bipolar. And so they really, like, knowing their triggers is extremely important to understanding how to manage their own mental health. So I know that this idea of knowing your triggers is universal to all types of mental health. Sorry, somehow I've lost the correct vocabulary in this situation, so you have to apologize. So examples I've put here, so lack of sleep. There's lots of research out there that shows that if you don't sleep enough, it will trigger some sort of mental health crisis. Like, most people who don't sleep will suddenly be more depressed or more anxious or have all kinds of other symptoms that they wouldn't necessarily have if they haven't slept. So sleeping is often a trigger for many people. Alcohol is a new discovery for me. And coffee. So I'll give you those two examples. I had a few people over for a bonfire the other day, and I had a few drinks, like not enough to make me feel inebriated, but anyway, a few. And this happened to me a few times. But suddenly it was an aha moment that this was due to the alcohol. I wake up in the middle of the night panicking. And then the next day I was like anxious all day long. And I spoke with a friend of mine who was also at a fire. And she said she had the same experience, two glasses of wine, and she barely slept. And I researched it because I'm like, this is a little ridiculous. And there's a word even it. It's called anxiety or something. So alcohol can be a trigger. Coffee, I've realized I can't even drink anymore because it makes my heart race, and then it just triggers anxiety immediately. So I have, and these are like, more physical examples, but feeling worthless. For me, worthlessness is my biggest trigger. I can tell you if I'm driving my car and someone cuts me off and I feel angry or hurt, it's because somehow my self-worth has been attacked. So in any possible situation that I'm going through a hard time, most likely somehow my self-worth is being at risk somehow. So you need to figure out what are the things in the world that are triggering you. Another, my friend, she can't go to weddings. They trigger her. If she's in a wedding, she starts losing it. She can't go to weddings. And that's fine. You learn what your triggers are, and then you either find ways to manage them, or if there are things you can avoid, you avoid them. Like I'm avoiding coffee, I'm avoiding alcohol, I'm really working on sleeping, which is a hard one for me. So we're gonna go into ways to cope with in a mental health crisis. So same as triggers, coping mechanisms are very individualized, and it really depends on you and your personality. So for me, not being alone is my biggest means of coping. So as you can tell, with the pandemic, it has put a huge impact on my capacity to cope because I'm an extrovert, and I always feel that extroversion has saved my life because when I'm in crisis, my reaction is not I need to be alone. My reaction is I need to be with other people. So that's my biggest coping strategy. It works almost every time. The moment I'm not feeling well, I have to be with other people. Focusing on the moment, mindfulness is also an incredibly valuable thing. Again, this Friday, like I said, I got completely triggered, and I was in such distress all weekend that the only thing I could focus on is, can I handle this very instant? I couldn't think of next minute. I couldn't think of in an hour. God forbid tomorrow. I had to tell myself, am I able to function right now? Am I okay in this very moment? Going for a walk, like sometimes, again, these are all personal examples, because I want you to understand they're not just words on a page. They have very, very concrete examples. And I want you to think about, you probably already know in your life, like, oh yeah, I do that. That's actually a strategy. Sometimes it's happened, a few times where I'm like so wound up, and the only thing I can do is just start moving, and that sort of helps to calm me down. I will move forward. Sometimes I'm so distressed, I have a hard time finding energy to clean my house, and my depression wants me to just lie on my couch and do nothing. But I've realized that causes me more distress, and if I just push myself through that sense of lack of energy, and I do still clean my house, even though I won't feel great after, I'll actually feel better than if I didn't do anything. I know breathing exercises work for a lot of people. They don't work for me. Taking a bath does not work for me. But a friend of mine the other day was full of anxiety. She's got this smartwatch. She lay down, she started doing breathing exercises, and she just watched her heart rate just go right down. So that's an example of something that does not work for me, but it works for other people. And there's a few examples of different kinds of coping strategies on this image at the bottom. Like pet therapy can be really good. Some people, it's about their pets. Working out, music can be really good for some people. For me, it's the opposite. I think that I'm probably the only person on the planet, but music is a trigger for me. I can't actually listen to music most of the time. When I'm around with some friends for whom music is their coping strategy, it's just very distressing for me sometimes, and I have to breathe through my evening because it's like nails on a chalkboard. It causes me an incredible amount of distress. So my point here is that coping strategies and triggers are very personal, and what works for you might not work for someone else. So I realize that I'm really close to the time. That's fine. These are the things I wanted to talk to you about the most. So I'm going to sort of cruise through the last slides, which sort of what my intention was anyway. So my point here in putting the slide is just to say that, like, you need to know yourself. I know it's hard. I know most people don't want to go through that work, but the more you know yourself, the more you're aware of what triggers you, of the things that make you feel better, the more you'll have techniques to manage your mental health. Like the crisis I went through on Friday was a massive crisis, massive. Like a few years ago, I think I would have been depressed for like months. I would have never made my, I've never gotten out of this crisis. And I, you know, I immediately called my mom. I wasn't alone. And I stayed in the moment all weekend. And I'm here. I am on Wednesday feeling really good. The crisis is over. So, but that's come with years of learning to listen to myself, to figure out what all the things that I can do that work for me. And I know that we want to repress things always seems like the best thing, but it really isn't. It always makes things worse. And so navigating your emotions is important. I had wanted to put more on spirituality and mental health, specifically because it's for the Catholic Association, but considering that there's so many different groups here, I just put something very generic, which is that spirituality can be very helpful to navigating your mental health. It's very helpful to me. It has been really transformational in my understanding of myself and my capacity to navigate the world. We're not obviously going to have time to touch this. All the things that I've talked about for coping strategies are the same for this. The difference here, though, is that the pandemic has created stressors that were not there before. So if you did not have even any problems with your mental health prior, suddenly all these new things have appeared. And so you're being triggered in ways that you have never been before. So although I could have spent more time here on this slide, I encourage you to just, figure out what is it you're not feeling. You're feeling disconnected. Like I had a bonfire at my house every single day for a whole year. And sure, there's a point where we were not allowed to see anyone. I'm single. I was allowed one person. And she sat in my backyard. We had a fire by ourselves. So that was my way of combating disconnection. I need to have people. So think about the ways that the pandemic is triggering you, and then think of ways that you can go around that. Burning out, again, very quickly. I'm never planning on staying on the slide very long. My intention, though, is just to remind you that your job is not your life. You might feel this sort of sense of loyalty, of duty to your job, of putting all this extra overtime and reading your email all days, all night. That does not help you disconnect from work. It helps you to stay on all the time, and it will increase the rate at which you burn out. You need to take your breaks. You need to let go. You need to not think of work after work. I know that's hard. You need to do it. Okay. My last slide is about exercise. There is so much research out there that says that antidepressants work the same for many disorders as medication. And of course, like here, that this example does say that it does not, like for severe depression, like antidepressants are still necessary. But there is many examples out there of research which states that exercise is an incredibly good substitute for medication. So exercise is important as well to manage your mental health. So I have put these two references here. We don't really have time to look at them, but they're there if you ever want to receive a PDF of the PowerPoint. I can send them to you. And then these two references are there. So we'll pause for questions. I'm assuming we're going to stop recording at this point. And then after that, I'll just briefly share an announcement. So I don't know, Julie. Yeah.
Yeah, so if anybody has any questions, you could put it in the chat, or you can raise your hand, or simply just pose the question. I could look and see, as I mentioned before, by using the reactions, you can see that you can raise your hand there, and then Anik can see that. Can you just stop your share?
Yeah.
Of your PowerPoint, and then we will have more room to see everybody. Just looking. I don't see anybody with their hand up.
Judy, I just saw your message saying that we can't see your pointer. It's unfortunate.